When you imagine a gourmet experience, what comes to mind? An elegant restaurant, perhaps, with a single candle flickering at the center of a luminous white tablecloth. Maybe a quartet plays somewhere in the romantic distance as the waiter slips a perfectly plated appetizer of escargot before you, and you proceed to nuzzle them out of their shells with silver tongs and that dainty fork. Perhaps this isn't your image. Perhaps yours includes a view of the Pacific shore, or the skyline of Manhattan, or a wine list as long as an actuarial table. But does your image include a taco truck? When Food & Wine magazine declared Roy Choi one of its best new chefs for 2010 for the food he was serving up in his Kogi barbecue truck, it signaled something like a sea change had happened in our idea of gourmet eating. And that's the very change that Alison Perlman explores in her book, Smart Casual: The Transformation of Gourmet Restaurant Style in America. As she puts it, between 1975 and 2010, the style of gourmet dining in America transformed. Increasingly, restaurants of fine dining incorporated food, decor, and other elements formerly limited to the casual dining experience. The result, as Perlman shows us, is a gourmet experience, quote, replete with eroded hierarchies and pointed style contrasts, convergences of hot and ordinary, end quote. And we might add, taco trucks. In a keen investigation of every element of the dining experience, from menus to molecular gastronomy, Perlman's book reveals the surprising nature of what fine dining means for us today. Alison Perlman, welcome to the New Books Network.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
It's fantastic to have you on the show. And you are the author of a relatively new book, Smart Casual, and I cannot wait to start talking about it. However, before we get into it, which is all about restaurant design, but in the largest sense possible,
yes.
I'm just kind of curious as to, you know, what brings a writer who normally works on contemporary art and has a book on art in the 80s to suddenly go into the way that restaurants are constructed and what that means.
Well, this may be me sort of reconnecting to my earlier self, because before I was an art historian, I was a lover of restaurants. This is, you know, even predates my choice to become an art historian. And this book is kind of a fusion of the interests. I mean, I really start with a love of restaurants, which I started to have as a child. My parents used to bring me with them. Thank you, parents. And, you know, at the time, of course, these places to me were seemed magical. You know, they seemed enchanting places. But of course, you know, as I grew older, got to have a little more of a critical eye and started to develop a sort of a sense for cultural analysis and decoding things, I became, well, no less enchanted with restaurants, but far more aware that the magic I thought I saw was the product of labor, was real, that this theater that was being constructed was something that I was took work and stagecraft and thought, and of course this got me even more interested in this topic. And as an art historian, I have an appreciation for stagecraft and for aesthetics. And the restaurant is just a gold mine. It's a gold mine topic for somebody who's interested in the visual world of the aesthetic. I find myself incredibly fascinated by every aspect of the vast visible spectrum of restaurants. There's not just architecture and interior design, but graphic design. You know, I mean, menus, for example, graphics, logos, the theatrical aspects, the theater of service, food itself, the composition of food. There's so much to talk about. There's so much to think about. When you talk about restaurants. So it has opened up for me, I think, as an art historian, a whole world of possibilities in terms of research and thinking about this. And because restaurants are so ubiquitous, such ubiquitous institutions in our society, it feels even more significant to me to deal with this stuff.
I think I've had many a friend who has said something to the effect of coming back from a restaurant, oh, the restaurant is a work of art, or oh, that meal was a work of art. And right. One of the things that's wonderful about this book is you take that almost literally with the degree of attention and analysis you bring to it. And I think that quick survey you've given us of all the facets is part of the pleasure of the book, of just seeing, you know, dimension after dimension of what it means to sit down in a restaurant and experience it open up.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. This is what I hope to do. I mean, there aren't that many. There are increasingly there are art historians who are getting into and thinking about food and restaurants. I think because the field of food studies has opened up to so many disciplines, you're going to see more of it. But when I started to do this, I think there were really not very many. But I hope there will be more.
And you find yourself to a large extent in conversation with sociologists.
Through and through. I mean, there are probably more references to sociologists in my book than there are to anything related to art history, actually. It's the art historian's eye, but it's the sociological concepts of about the, especially the, for instance, the concept of omnivorousness that comes from sociology.
So that would be, I think, an interesting place to start with the book. So a lot of listeners who are interested in food and who might be listening to the New Books Network food channel would have an idea of what omnivorousness means through Michael Pollan and his right. work, The Dilemma of What to Eat When You Can Eat Anything. And you have a very different idea of the omnivore's dilemma.
Absolutely. I think it's actually a different sense in which Michael Pollan means the term. And he really is talking, I think, about the biological omnivore who can eat everything, and that in a biological sense. But there's a cultural definition of omnivore as well. And that's really more the lineage that I'm coming from, is what I'm rooted in, I think, and in sociology, is this sociology of taste, cultural preferences. And so the omnivore I'm talking about is an omnivore cultural consumer, a consumer of culture rather than of a biological foodstuff. So this concept of the omnivore comes out of actually work from the early 90s by a pair of sociologists, Richard Peterson and Albert Simkus, who basically did a study of, this wasn't related to food at all, actually. It was actually related to a study of musical tastes, musical preferences in the United States. And they did a study of musical preference by occupation. A sort of an occupation was the index was to occupations, which was sort of a way of defining class in a way, or social, a kind of combination of social status and class. And they found that people in occupations that came along with maybe a higher income and a high social status were not as they expected or as had previously been talked about in sociology, most famously associated with the sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, the notion that higher classes or higher ranking folks in society would have a taste for highbrow art or highbrow music in this case. And the two sociologists I'm talking about from the early 90s found that was not the case. In fact, that people of a high rank had very varied musical tastes. They liked classical music, but they also liked various forms of popular music. And so they called this tendency, which they found particularly pronounced in these higher ranking or, you know, kind of high status occupations, to be a specific pattern among them that was about the range of their consumption. What defined them culturally and was their range of consumption, not an exclusive sort of even snobbish association of themselves with highbrow tastes only. And this idea of omnivorous consumption and preferences and taste is exactly parallel to what I'm talking about with the foodie sensibility, which is precisely omnivorous.
Yes, it takes us right to the story you have to tell, which is you begin in 1975 with Chez Panisse, right? Mm-hmm. And we suddenly start to find ourselves moving towards a very different idea of what it means to enter into a gourmet restaurant. And it's not highbrow.
Right.
What would a highbrow have been, and how did we lose it?
Yeah, well, that's the story, right? What highbrow would have been is a kind of restaurants that, and the standard was set in some ways by post-World War II places that had a real almost, giant status at the time, like Le Pavillon in New York. I guess on the West Coast, maybe a corresponding place might have been Ernie's in San Francisco. These places that had were French, first of all, French food, French menus, often the language of the menu itself would be French, and or sort of, you know, at least continental menus with French language. So you kind of had to be familiar with that or comfortable with that. There was a certain traditional forms of luxury prevailed, traditions upheld in terms of restaurant decor. Oh, there are certain things, chandeliers, fresh flowers, you know, a certain maybe silk, velvet or silk curtains.
An imperious maitre d'.
And a maitre d' was a central character to the whole thing. In fact, really, probably the most powerful personality of the restaurant was the maitre d', as opposed to the chef, which becomes really the new focal point of the new style of gourmet restaurant, that the chef is the central personality as opposed to the maitre d'. So Chez Panisse is one of those turning point places, certainly for that, but also because of for a style that was much more in love with instead of the grande cuisine, you know, the haute cuisine, French haute cuisine. It was in love with the cuisine bourgeoise of and even taking elements later. Chez Panisse went through various phases of its menus too, but at every point. Was innovative in the process, by the way, including in its architecture. I mean, at one point, although Chez Panisse opened in 71 and got that incredible press recognition in 75, which I think was an important moment of influence for it. But in 1980, the place was one of the first restaurants to create an open kitchen, which was so profoundly influential ultimately as well. And that really was another key innovative moment for that restaurant.
So you take us through this journey, and one of the chapters of the book kind of looks at these landmark restaurants and landmark moments within their history. Mm-hmm. And we arrive at one point at a taco truck.
Yeah.
Which receives a Michelin star. And the prose at that moment is just delightfully kind of perplexed at what has happened as you begin to analyze it. So what is the significance of the taco truck to your argument?
Well, this is interesting, the taco truck. Okay, so you're talking about the chef is Roy Choi, who's a Los Angeles-based chef who's still innovating and doing interesting things here, by the way. But the taco truck started it all for Roy Choi and for a lot of things. It was actually what I started with there. I think what you're referring to is that there's this a recognition that the Kogi barbecue taco truck is what it's called, the Kogi truck, received in 2010. It was actually a Food and Wine magazine best chef, one of the 10 best chefs, and Food and Wine would come out with these, and still does come out with these best chef issues, and he was one of them. That's what the recognition you're talking about was, and he was one of the 10. And at that time, this was before he had opened up all kinds of restaurants, which he has now. But he was primarily known for starting a food truck. And this food truck craze that everybody is still very familiar with, and now every town in America and well beyond America, well beyond the United States, has food trucks. But he's kind of considered the ground, the patient zero of the food truck movement, you know? He's the one who started that and how influential that was. And what he was doing, of course, and what was worthy of recognition by Food and Wine magazine. This is what makes it interesting. The gourmet recognition here involved was that this was probably the most casual, the most informal thing you could possibly have given a fine dining chef award to, for someone who was doing something culinarily experimental, culinarily groundbreaking with food in a taco truck. And he was making basically Korean tacos, among other things, mixing the traditions of Korean cuisine and Mexican cuisine, which are really, really huge out here in Los Angeles. And it was a very Los Angeles concept in that sense. And he was making something really new, really delicious. And I think the innovation, understanding that what really mattered here was innovation. And he was an innovator. And this is also really important to this culture, the foodie culture that became the dominant foodie culture that we still have today, is the emphasis on innovation and a kind of self-expression and an openness to cultural diversity. All of these are elements that play a really large role in the culture of the contemporary foodie scene. So he is a poster child for that. And it made sense that he would be recognized. Now that you think, even though at the time it seemed kind of rather amazing that a taco truck, somebody who was known for a taco truck would get this, an honor that usually goes to fine dining chefs, and did go to otherwise fine dining chefs in the group of 10 that were featured on that, in that issue.
And what's quite wonderful about one of the journeys the books makes is that you take us from a cuisine and an environment that you know, maybe it's a stretch to say this, but something like Escoffier would have recognized. And suddenly we're in a place where there's a taco truck and we're still talking about gourmet eating. And that's the moment that I think you're trying to launch a definition of what it now means to eat gourmet, to do fine dining.
Right. And actually, you know, if you think about what's going on at the same, what is interesting too is it's the taco truck, but it's also the French Laundry at the same time. I mean, there's a way in which the very the still formal and really fine, really high style cuisine is still being appreciated. It's not. I don't want to overstress the point about the casual, because it's actually the simultaneity of these two things. It's the fact that a restaurant like this very, very high style, very intricate, labor-intensive, super-composed white tablecloth situation that you would have in a restaurant, say, like the French Laundry in the Napa Valley, simultaneously at the same time as the taco truck of Roy Choi, that those two things are having an influence on the gourmet culture at the same time. And I think that's really the omnivorous aspect, right? It's that the foodie culture is able to, or wants to, appreciate both at the same time. So I don't want to suggest that the formality is gone, because in a lot of ways it's not gone, although it changes. What formality becomes does also change itself, and that's also something true. So it's the casual aspect, the informal innovators like Roy Choi in the case of the taco truck, but at the same time it's also a new kind of formality is emerging at the same time that is new and different.
And I would say that one of the constants in the story you had to tell as the style of restaurants in America changes and you begin to note them is that cultural and economic capital don't go away as key factors, right? Money and status are still very much a part of this story.
Absolutely. It's just that the rules of the game have changed. You know, we still have a hierarchy. That's really it. It's just the terms of that hierarchy. What counts, what matters, what the status markers are, have changed. And what's really, I think, a key shift is the shift away from mastery or having to have mastered. In other words, to show your status, if you are a diner, to show your status previously, it was about mastering traditional forms, whether they were sartorial conventions of, dress codes, whether they were a behavioral, knowing which fork to use, being comfortable with the kind of traditions of service, knowing what to expect in a restaurant, being able to read the French menu, things like that defined basically sorted out the people who belonged from the people who did not belong, and then that what changed was you have now, if you think about the equivalent in formality, I guess the equivalent in terms of high style cuisine would be, say, a restaurant like Alinea in Chicago. I mean, here is the pinnacle in some ways of still a sort of fine dining idea. But it is so radically different as to what separates the diner as a sophisticated diner in that situation is completely different from what it would have been, say, pre-75. I mean, if you are a sophisticated diner of at Alinea in Chicago is somebody who knows to expect the unexpected and is just going there to be adventurous and is willing to accept the whatever things might come because they know that they're dealing with innovation rather than tradition. I think the emphasis on innovation and appreciation of something new. And so you'll find if you go to a place like that, that even the utensils that you get are unfamiliar and you're not expected to know how to use them. They'll tell you how to use the utensil. In fact, because they designed the utensil, which looks like nothing from, you've ever seen before. Also part of the innovative nature of the restaurant, right, is the actual serviceware that you're using that has been specially designed for that restaurant. So it's not, do you know how to use that fork? It's of course you don't know how to use the fork. Let me and don't expect to, you wouldn't expect that, but it's your openness to trying the strange fork that really defines you. And also another thing, a new kind of a willingness to attend to the minutiae of the chef's work and even the sommelier's work. After all, they've become really important players too in crafting that dining experience. So you are somebody who is now kind of willing to pay attention to the work and appreciate the work and the innovation and the artistry that you're going to be receiving over what could be up to a 3-hour, 4-hour meal. So there's a new kind of demanding, there's a new demand for attentiveness. And that's almost like that's a separator too. That's a distinguisher socially. So do you have the capacity to pay attention to these subtleties? Do you have the capacity to, and these may be unfamiliar things. In fact, they should be unfamiliar things. So a real difference in what the new formality looks like versus the old.
Well, I've been wanting to ask you this question because you also write about art. And so as I was reading this analysis, which I think is fascinating, right? There's something about, therefore, the role of the eater. And how does normative judgment figure in anymore? It used to be that a discerning diner, you could take a traditional dish and you could say, this chef is doing it beautifully, right? That would be a kind of traditional model of, oh, I'm at a French restaurant, I've never tasted this particular dish done so well, therefore this is good. When innovation becomes the standard, this is something that I have never seen before, right? Good and bad tend to get, the rhetoric of good and bad tends to get replaced by something like surprising, heretofore unseen. But suddenly, you know, it's very much a kind of, I almost want to say, passive position of the diner to appreciate rather than to judge, to accept.
Oh, perhaps you're suggesting that if I understand you correctly, you might maybe saying that when there's a standard, you can judge, is this good or bad based on my knowledge of the standard? In other words, as opposed to if I am faced with something I've never seen before, I have no basis for judgment. So all I can do is accept its newness. Is that kind of what you're suggesting?
Which I often find will be a response that I will have to certain things, that, you know, conceptual things in contemporary art or something. I will shrug and say, right, fascinating,
right,
you know, and then there's, you know, I see something in molecular gastronomy being served on a utensil that I've never seen before, and I shrug and I say, fascinating, but there's very little context in which to place it besides innovation and newness.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's interesting. I mean, I think that still somehow the critics and even us as individuals still find a way to judge, don't we? I mean, I find judgment doesn't seem to have gone away. In spite of all of this potential problem that you rightly point out, I think that in spite of that, we see everywhere judgment. And just from a personal standpoint, I think that you, when faced with something like that, I myself, I mean, also get judgmental, and I find myself judging on the basis of whether I think it, more sort of meta kind of larger artistic criteria about, is this necessary? Does this function well? Is it pleasing? Is it interesting enough? Was it worth doing? You know, there's still some of these larger questions that you know, because I think you can still separate, or at least I find that I'm still able to separate something that was done purely as a novelty or as a gimmick or something like that was not enhancing anything, but seemed merely for the show of doing it. And then the ridiculousness of that gesture becomes apparent.
And so there you have innovation for innovation's sake, rather right, than newness for some purpose other than itself.
Right. And in fact, this was precisely the criticism that was leveled against Nouvelle Cuisine when it got to become worthy of parody by the early 80s in the United States, because there was a point, I mean, this, in the United States, Nouvelle Cuisine was kind of became faddish a bit after the French trend, which was earlier, and there were the imitators, you know, just as today there are the imitators of the molecular, you know, the molecular cuisine modernist cuisine. Now they seem to like to call it modernist cuisine, and they can be bad, you know, like pointless foams or, you know, things that you're trying to reimagine a dish or deconstruct a familiar dish, but it wasn't worth, there was nothing gained by the deconstruction, you know, things like that happen all the time. And I think that's just what happens with trends. But I still think that, you know, those kinds of distinctions between is this aesthetically working, or is this something really substantially new, or is this just a tinkering around the edges? I think that you can still figure out, and as just an individual trying to you know, exercise judgment and you know, aesthetic discernment over these kinds of things, which we all do. We inevitably do it.
I don't think the stars on Yelp will ever go away.
No, we love that. We love to play judge. I mean, that's one of the things that delights me so much about these programs, like, you know, The Voice, you know, the competition programs, you know, the reality shows where you find competing singers or something like that, right? We love to judge. And I think insofar as those shows can get us to appreciate the artistry or the craft, I guess you could say, behind these, you know, the work that it takes to to do these things and get us to appreciate and understand more what goes into it, in the sense of the labor, but also the creativity. We're kind of enriched by judgment in that sense, the more we get to sort of understand what's involved. So it's worth it. It's worth trying to judge.
I think that the competition shows that feature food that's all the more so, because at least when people are competing through singing or designing new fashions, you can see it, you can hear it. So you have a standard, a personal standard against which you can judge the judges. But when you can't taste the food, that seems to be a big part of it. Just, suddenly you see the pleasure of the spectacle of watching judging.
Well, you bring up a really important point, and actually something really fascinating for me about contemporary food culture is how visual it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is why I feel even more excited about, as an art historian, dealing with this material, because it's food production has become more and more visual. I mean, that isn't to say that it isn't tasted. I mean, of course, obviously, it's still about taste. But insofar as you have the machinery of social media, you have both the consumers themselves, obviously the food, but pictures of your food have become as probably as common as posting pictures of yourself
Children.
Exactly. Of your pets, right? And that has become an incredible visual culture machine. And so the food the consumers are doing it, but also, fascinatingly, the food producers are doing it. I one of the sort of little phenomena that I have find fascinating now is increasingly the restaurants and top restaurants kind of getting into the game of video production. I mean, they're putting up things on YouTube, little short films, little productions that they've become video producers, film producers in a way, in addition to food producers. So this is a new kind of phenomenon, which tells you how important the visual is now as part of the food experience.
So this might be an extension of a phenomenon that you devote a lot of attention to in the book, which is the exhibition kitchen. You mentioned it in passing.
Right.
But here's this moment where you can actually see supposedly behind the scenes to get educated on how a master chef would work, to have the thrill of encountering this kind of artistry as it happens.
Exactly. And yet.
I knew there was an "and yet."
And yet. Right. So there's this. Okay. So the exhibition kitchen, I guess if it pretends to show you the kitchen, right? That's the conceit, right? It pretends to open up the kitchen to your view as a diner so that you can see in to how the food is made. I mean, that's the basic pretense of the exhibition kitchen. But the exhibition is doing so much more than that. And I think this I pay attention to quite a bit in the book, as you say. And how, talk about stagecraft. And what's fascinating about, they're designed in a very particular way for the most part. Of course, there are different types of exhibition kitchens. We have different models, different variations that exist. There's the there are kitchens that are open to the entire dining room, and that's kind of a stage-like kitchen. You have situations where there is like a counter, a kitchen counter type of an arrangement where diners sit over a counter like as if they're at a bar, and they sit there and eat and they see directly into the kitchen, very much more intimate situation. And there's also, of course, the variation known as the chef's table, which is sometimes actually inside a very special table, which you usually have to pay more for to sit inside the kitchen itself. And that's, of course, that can be the most prestigious of all. Talk about a turnaround, by the way, in taste. Back in the day that I say we moved away from, sitting even near the kitchen was like you got the worst seat in the house, Obviously, the maitre d' didn't like you or thought you were unimportant, you know, to put you in such a bad seat. But now you want to pay $100 more per person so that you can sit inside the kitchen. You know, this is a complete reversal. But it says a lot about what the kitchen means to people. First of all, what this theater is in a way doing. It's certainly about a kind of chef worship, but at the same time, it's the chef presented in a very idealized manner. And that's what I try to argue, is that, you know, it is a form of chef worship, but it's also a very particular, almost kind of mystification of the chef's work, or at kitchen labor, which is identified with the profession of the chef. And it does this in a variety of ways, through the stagecraft of the actual design of these kitchens, the way that they're structured, what you can see as a diner and what you cannot see, what they tend to show and highlight in terms of the work that's done in the kitchen, or and work that's done so-called off stage. There's a lot of on stage, off stage dynamics with these open kitchens that are fascinating and say a lot about what it is that is being presented as a version of the chef's work, version of kitchen work, and what's being concealed, what's being downplayed. So there's definitely a mystification going on, a desire to see the work of the kitchen work in a way that, you know, actually what it comes down to is it's a highlighting of the most sensual, the most fast moving, the most small scale, the individual plate, the scale of individual plate presentation and plate plating. And, you know, the part where the people working right at the edge of kitchen and diner or table are doing work that appears to be the most artistic and in the sense of plating, in the sense of composing as if painting on the plate. And that's a very late stage in cooking. That's a very particular stage in cooking. Most of the cooking has already been done. Most of the, you know, carving up of the animal and a lot of the disgusting sorts of work and a lot of the slow moving, stock making things take hours, gross and disgusting and slow and industrial scale, large pots stage of the work has largely happened off stage, you know?
As far as I know, the French Laundry does still not offer a dishwasher's table.
Oh.
Where you can go in and watch the dishes that are coming out of the dining room get cleaned. You're right there next to the steam and the power washers. Yeah.
Right. That's it. That's the one.
Well, it seems then kind of counterintuitive, if we're appreciating the artistry of these chefs as mystified as it is, and we're looking at these transformations, you know, that we're being staged to, or we're being set up to appreciate a kind of production of mastery and mystery and, you know, the chef artist, that the chef artist would be making hamburgers and macaroni and cheese. You also have an interesting comfort food and how this fits into the vision of fine dining today.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing. Comfort food. And by the way, I can't believe that I still find this term in use. I thought it would go away, but actually it's still there. I still hear it. I thought it would have sort of worn out its welcome by now, but it has been chugging along for it's been around for quite a while, since actually the mid 70s. But it really got going in the 90s and then, you know, exploded in the 2000s, this term comfort food. And it always seems to be sort of used in a similar way. Something about the familiar, but also the sense of solace, of comfort, obviously, but really it comes down to familiarity, a sense of all-inclusive comfort, sort of almost like a social comfort, that something is being comforted that is that needs to be comforted about us through the inclusiveness, or being and treated as familiars and familiarity. So this quality of comfort food, what's interesting about it is it gets applied to all kinds of food. It gets applied to any kind of common food, and it could be from any tradition. It has gotten to be applied to things that are like hamburgers, as you point out, hamburgers, mac and cheese. These kind, that's a type of food. That's a type of I would call a massified food. Food that's broadly familiar, that has become part of our industrialized food system, part of the what's available and associated no longer with any one particular ethnic group, but is instead a kind of massified, a product of the modern food system. But there's also comfort food being used to describe what some people call slow food, and a food that is associated with traditions of regional traditions of indigenous and pre-modern, the you know, rooted traditions of food, also being called comfort food. So in a way, we have the embrace of foodies of both types of foods under the umbrella of comfort food. So comfort, and these are contradictory things, by the way. That's what's one of the fascinating things about this, is that they are contradictory sources. One, you know, slow food, in a sense, right, is about a worship of the traditional indigenous rooted regional tradition that does not get massified, but that precisely resists being massified. Whereas fast food, right, in a sense, is the modern industrialized, you know, crossing boundaries, disregarding region kind of food. But that's equally embraced in this situation. So you have to wonder what is going on with this umbrella term. What kind of differences is it sort of blanketing over? And that's something that I definitely deal with in the book, that there's some kind of cultural tension. And I relate it to a kind of increasing pluralism in our society that is, in a sense, comforted by the massified foods, that this is actually something we can all recognize in spite of our cultural differences, in spite of the great deal of pluralism in our culture ethnically that we have, which has increased over the decades quite strongly, especially in places where gourmet culture is concentrated, in urban areas. So in a sense, I speculate on that this is comforting. The comfort food is comforting in a cultural sense, that we recognize, we hang on to something that unites us. But at the same time, the diversity of comfort food ethnically on the slow side of the spectrum is also a way that foodies can be cosmopolitan, can distinguish themselves as sophisticates at the same time. So I think that these two things are really both serving a function in terms of, you know, the embrace of them are both serving a kind of cultural function that's important for the foodie demo, you know, the foodie demo, you could say.
Yeah, and I'd like to emphasize for our listeners that one of the things you do in the book, which is surprising, is that you connect some of these very, we could say, small-scale trends happening inside restaurants with huge changes in the way our nation thinks about itself over the last couple of decades. So you hook it up with changes in American demographics, with economics, with education, with the way the workforce has changed from manufacturing jobs to the creative class. And so there's this sense in which you can go very, very closely from a kind of micro-analysis of how the menus are now working to the way in which our country has changed over the last 30 years.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, there's definitely a big project of the book is to make that connection, between these things that we find stylistically going on in the restaurant scene and this larger cultural shift. Because yes, some of what we see in the restaurant culture can be explained by talking about the restaurant industry, about specifically consumers of the restaurant, of gourmet restaurants, the foodies, for example, and that specific culture. But I think that I try to put foodie culture in a larger context, too. And there's a lot of the traits that they exhibit, for instance, the appreciation, the worship of chefs, the particular worship of chefs, for example, the figure of the chef and the way it's the way that figure is worshipped is along the lines that are the very values of a sort of meritocracy culture. It's not unlike, I mean, to embrace and in a sense worship individual achievement, innovation, right? Creativity, self-expression, openness to cultural diversity. These are meritocratic values. These are the so-called creative class values that have become kind of normative over the, you know, in the post-50s America. And so I think that there's a larger context. You're right. I mean, there's a larger context in which we can see that the foodie culture we're seeing is very much a very niche, perhaps expression of these larger trends, which do have to do with broader cultural, economic, labor force trends that have to do with the nature of occupations, the increase in the so-called creative class, right, which basically is a term that I borrow from the economist Richard Florida, who is the one who's famous for this definition of creative class. He defines this class in terms of occupation and types of occupations, occupations that are focused or center on new idea development or problem-solving skills that require high levels of education. This is the kind of work, and he talks about this type of work being something that has expanded quite strongly since the 1950s, say. That kind of work or those kinds of jobs were 15% of the labor force, whereas now they're about 30% of the labor force. And he makes a strong case, I think, of about that culture also being a leading labor sector in the economy. Not the service sector actually is a larger. It's 45% of the labor force, but the creative class, which is 30%, which is less, is a more decisive and leading trend-setting force because they tend to play more leading roles in the economy. And so they set norms more. This is kind of the argument that I think I'm trying to build on and apply to the culinary scene. And all of this is supported, I think, by trends. If you look at education, the boom in higher education since after the 1950s, especially after the mid 60s, with the Higher Education Act, for instance, and ethnic diversification, the concentration of education, income, and ethnic diversity in urban areas, which starts to increase markedly since the 70s, by the way, all of these things are shifts that are kind of affecting and shaping this culture, this particular meritocratic culture, and the upholding of nonconformity as a dominant ethos, which is kind of a complete paradox, right? I mean, nonconformity as a dominant ethos, but it's true. I mean, what we have a culture that says, think different, right?
Break all the rules.
Break all the rules, right? I mean, if that doesn't say it, I don't know what does. So that's not just happening in cuisine, right? It's happening in a larger cultural space.
Well, given the fact that your intellectual curiosity will range from what's on the plate to what's going on in the repopulation of American cities, where are you turning to next now that you've completed this project?
Well, I am deep into it right now. As we speak, I am deep into a new project. It's a new book that is going to be take on the restaurant menus. And especially on the question, menus are fascinating documents, by the way. Menus are, I mean, as graphic design, as literature, as rhetoric, you know, as sales pitches, but also as kind of, they're like theatrical programs and scripts as well. Menus are fascinating things, restaurant menus. And I'm going to deal with all kinds of genres. I'm going to break out of the Smart Casual dealt with gourmet culture. This book is going to deal with every kind of restaurant imaginable, but menus and the different genres of menus. And it's going to deal with the whole question of how choice is constructed in menus and how menus are related to our sort of the dynamics of consumer choice in our culture. So there will be a larger cultural angle there too, but dealing with the menu. After all, the menu presents you with a choice, or at least it seems like it does.
Well, I hope when you finish it, you'll come back and talk to us about it.
I would love to.
Alison Perlman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Eric. It was a pleasure.
My name is Eric LeMay, and you've been listening to an interview with Alison Perlman, author of Smart Casual, The Transformation of Gourmet Restaurant Style in America, on the New Books Network.